listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. This is the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got another potluck for you, partially because we love doing them, partially because I just got my vaccine and I am rocked right now.
Yeah.
Today, we are sponsored by three awesome companies. First one is Prismic. They are a headless CMS focused on building websites with slices, LogRocket, JavaScript Session Replay, and RevenueCat, adding recurring billing to your mobile app with no sweat. How you doing today, Scott?
Hey, I could be a little bit more caffeinated. I wanted to stop drinking coffee or having caffeine in the morning just to, you know, see if that would help out some of my like pain issues that I have. And like, oh man, I don't even know what I was thinking today. I could have gone to the coffee shop and like, no, I didn't. And so it's what, like 1:30 over here and I am crashing. But you know what? I'm talking to Wes, I'm talking to Webb. We're doing a potluck. I'm going to wake up here. I'm going to wake me up before I go, and I'm going to do this podcast very, very with lots of energy. So yeah, I'm doing good. How about you?
Not too bad. As I said, I just got my vaccine yesterday, which I'm stoked about. A little bit sleepy today, feeling a little bit groggy, but I'm very happy to have it. And I'm excited for JavaScript meetups and conferences and all that to start coming back soon. So excited about that.
Yeah, I'm pumped for that too.
All right, first question we have here is from Steve Montoya. Most small businesses I know have heard of WordPress, and it seems like the industry standard for doing brochure websites. So brochure website generally means like this is just a website that has content on it, and it doesn't do a whole lot other than show photos and content and information that people need. Maybe there's a contact form on there and that's about it. It doesn't do much else. So I'm tired of 1-to-5 page freelance WordPress websites. I love front-end coding and design. Do I need to sell people on static sites, or are there freelance jobs out there to use Vue, React, whatever for static site web developers? I want to stick with small businesses and a few other niches, but I'm tired of drag and drop builders in WordPress. Plus, I feel WordPress is overkill for the majority of the sites that I do. I just want to code sites and freelance things. So this is a frustration that this Steve has, is he wants to use maybe a little bit more advanced tech, but the types of clients that he's working with and like the, it sounds like he's happy with the clients that he's getting and the sort of the little niche he's carved out. They are still using WordPress. So like, what do you do there? And I'm very curious to hear what you think about this, Scott. You want to give a stab first?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I don't really think the client does care. Even if they think they do, the client doesn't necessarily know as much about what you're doing or the tech is. Maybe they might even let on. I used to have some clients who would like try to give me some jargon to let them know that they knew what HTML was, and okay. But at the end of the day, they care about results, what's faster, what works better, what feels better. And it very well may be your job to sell them on something that is bigger, faster, stronger. Well, not bigger. Let's say smaller, faster, stronger. It might be up to you to sell them on that. Now, many of the times that involves issues where clients really think they need to enter data or update the data or be in regards to have more control over that information. But in my experience, we had just an endless amount of clients who asked for a WordPress site specifically and then never ever changed it. And that's only because somebody told them that they needed WordPress. There is a time and a place for you to say, like, whether or not you're in that client meeting or if it's through your team and you're discussing it with your team and saying, listen, I can build the site in a way that's going to feel better for the user, but it's not going to be on WordPress. If this client is, you know, WordPress is a deal breaker, I can do it in WordPress. But hey, maybe we should try something different for this one and then see how it goes. In my experience, the team that I was working with at any of the agencies I worked at typically did not care about that. They would say, okay, and maybe perhaps in your proposal, because I know a lot of you are bidding on proposals. That's a lot of how that work works, is where you bid for a project. And if you get the project, and if you say this thing is not going to be on WordPress, that could be seen as a downside. So if you're doing the type of proposal work in that regard, you might need to say like, listen, we can build the site in WordPress if you'd like, or we can explore newer, you know, newer technologies that can give you a better experience. And if you add some flowery language to it, you can like you could, you know, the guy at the who's selling something say, you can have this old thing, or you can have this fancy new one with a shiny roof. You know, you could sell it a little bit that way. And I think that will go to your benefit. It's all going to be about selling the client on, you know, letting them know what they need versus what they think they need. Because oftentimes the client thinks they need something different than they actually do.
Yeah, it's kind of tough with trying to do static or Jamstack or any of these, like even just like a dynamic React site, because a lot of times the benefits that you get in terms of speed and kind of slickness of the website don't outweigh the benefits of somebody using WordPress. That's why people use WordPress a lot still, because the client wants, I just have a few notes here, something that's easy to update themselves. In some cases, they'll usually tell you, like Scott says, they'll say, I want to update it, but doesn't always be the case. They want something that's mobile friendly, both on the site, but as well as be able to make small edits. I know all of my friends who run small businesses, they are very heavy running on iPads and phones over sitting at a desktop computer, because unless they're actually doing a desk job, they're running around and then they just do stuff from their phone. Like I did I remember I did a website for a bricklaying company, like a huge, like probably the biggest bricklaying company in North America. And they were like, people who are on this website, they're not sitting at a desk. They are on their phone while they're slamming a Tim's, which is our coffee here. And they're just kind of like scrolling through it on their phone. So you need to think about that. They want preview friendly. This is a big downside that Jamstack is frustrating with right now, is that when you make an update to your content, they want to see it on the content on the site very soon, if not right away. They want easy to add features, photo gallery, map, slider, snow day notice. We talked about that. That is like, if something goes wrong, like they have to shut down for the day, they want to be able to put a big banner on the homepage. And then they want easy to click together pages with some sort of builder, which is why like a lot of people hate these site builders, because they, especially some of the WordPress ones, they do everything under the sun and they can be hard to work with. But on the flip side, a lot of people actually love using this type of thing. So I don't know. I don't think that the Jamstack is there yet. And I think if you take a look at the landscape of companies trying to solve this right now, Stackbit has been a sponsor in the past. They're simply just gluing together like your CMS and your front-end framework, but they are being like the piece in between. Sanity has live preview. You can hook it up with your Gatsby site and immediately see the updates. Tina CMS is another one where you can view the website and click on the thing you want to edit. Next.js is rolling out this new live thing, which allows you to sort of collaborate and see what other people are doing. Gatsby Cloud, real-time updates. So it's kind of funny. You see all of these companies spending lots and lots of money trying to figure this out right now. So if I were you, I would say I would like look towards what all these companies are doing in that space, because I bet that's the next step in terms of building portfolio, or what do we call it? Not portfolio, brochure websites for clients.
Yeah. And you also got to be a little cognizant that just because you would like to build a site on a fancy thing doesn't mean that that's what's best for your client too. So, you know, don't shoehorn a Gatsby site into a situation that really does.
Kubernetes stack.
Yeah. That does really want a WordPress site at the end of the day. You know what I mean? Because then nobody's going to be happy. All right. Next question here is from Aiden G. Says, hi, Scott and Wes, loving the podcast all the way from the UK. I wanted to get your opinion on the third-party cloud services that provide application functionality, things like Auth0, Algolia, OpenCart, etc. I work for a large enterprise where there is a real fear of trusting these companies with our data, and so everything is built from the ground up. With less time, we miss out on a lot of the sweet features these services provide. Do you use many services like this in your production apps, and how would you decide about which ones to use? So this is a tough call here, because at the end of the day, you only know so much about these services. I'm not going to call out a service specifically, but there was a service that I used. I never used them heavily. I explored this service just to see. And I got an email a couple of days ago from them about a data breach. And the stuff that's in the data breach is scary. It's like your security keys and stuff. Oh, we accidentally had all of the ENV like variables from all of the sites that wherever on the service leaked. Very scary. So like there are definitely real reasons for that fear. Now, should that mean you never use any services? I don't necessarily agree with that. Companies like Auth0, I mean, their whole thing is authentication. So their security better be down pat or else they're not going to have a reputation for being, you know, authentication.
Yeah.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that I've personally done an audit of any of their stuff. And even if I did, that doesn't mean that I would even be able to understand, you know, the security implications of that. So yeah, it's a tough call. And at the end of the day, we're all kind of blindly trusting a lot of these services, some of which maybe we should and shouldn't. I think a good benchmark for that are services that have existed for a good amount of time and have a good track record. If something just popped up and it's like built overnight kind of deal, maybe sit and wait on that type of thing. But you have companies like you mentioned, Algolia, Auth0. Those are all companies that have, you know, really proven track records and have been around for a good amount of time. So personally, I would do the work to make sure that the company and the service that I'm using is something that other people have trusted information in and for a long time or for a decent amount of time. It's a tough call because you could say like, I mean, like Next, was it Vercel? Vercel's brand new and I trust hosting my stuff on Vercel. And I have no issues or no concerns about that. So I guess I don't know. It's a really tough call. There is a huge amount of cost associated with building it yourself in terms of just the sheer amount of labor that it takes to not only build but maintain something. So it's a tough, tough, tough call.
I always try to lean on doing it myself or at least be able to do it myself. That's one of the reasons why like my personal website doesn't use something like Cloudinary to host my images. It's not that like I use it on my course platform. I'm a big fan of them. I use them in a lot of my courses, things like that. But like my personal website, I'm just like, I feel like I like entirely just build it myself. You know, if I wanted to host the thing myself, I totally could. But at a certain point that like time versus trade-off and expertise goes away. Like I am not going to get into the business of hosting my own video. I might go down the route like Scott did and build your own player with something like Mux, but I like lean on someone like Vimeo to do my videos. Why? Because I don't have the expertise to do that type of things. I don't want to have to maintain the infrastructure. They honestly do it cheaper than if I were to try to do it raw myself. So that's always a pro to using a service. Also, you have a really nice UI. It's fast to implement a service. The cons to that is it can get expensive really quickly. If you look at some of these, like when you start to scale things up to millions and millions of requests or big pieces of data, then you go, oh boy, this is getting really, really expensive. So yeah, you just got to kind of think about what are the pros and cons. Obviously, you can't do much these days without services entirely. At some point, you probably have to buy a domain name unless you're pointing people to an IP address, which you are hosting yourself. And then even then you still have to pay an ISP to get to that, right? So at some point along the line, you have to say, all right, I'm letting these companies into part of my website and I'm going to trust them to do that type of thing. But in my own personal experience, I always like to lean to try to do it yourself and see how much time it's going to do. And then if it's way too much overhead or way too much upkeep or it's way too expensive, and sometimes it makes sense to lean on a service for that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, like continuous integration, something like Vercel or Netlify, those like continuous integration builds. Like, I guess you can host your own. What's the one that you can host yourself?
That host yourself, GitLab. You can do continuous integration in GitLab.
There's another one that was out there.
We use GitHub Actions for all of that stuff, but I know what you're talking about.
CircleCI, that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. Semaphore, CircleCI. There's a bunch of those.
And you could host that yourself, but like, man, I love using services for that type of thing because sometimes if something goofs up and I'm on my phone, I could just log in and hit rebuild or merge a pull request from GitHub. And I like having companies part of my stack at that point.
Totally.
So One of our first question was these site builders can in WordPress can get really, really frustrating. So one, this ad read will cover both of our last questions. One, should you pay a service instead of building it yourself? So one of those services you could pay to be your CMS is Prismic. They have a very generous free plan as well, but they are a service. And then the other part is a page builder. So Prismic is going all in on this thing called slices, which is essentially you take your website, you chop it up into components. You've got your hero component and maybe a product features component and maybe a team members component. And then you each of the pieces of data on that component, you can make an input for that component. Then what you do to build a website is you just grab those slices together and put the data. You're like, okay, I need three people components, and then I want a slider, and then I want a hero. It's like a page builder. And then you can go into your React or your Svelte or your Vue or whatever you're building it in, query all those slices along with the data that is in them, and then go ahead and render out. So that might be a good solution for that. Check it out, Prismic. PRISMIC.io/syntax. Thank you, Prismic, for sponsoring.
Sick. Okay, this next question is from Aaron H. Hi, fellas. Love the show. Bless you. Thank you, Aaron. I recently took Wes's advanced React course and went on to build my first custom React app. Thanks, Wes.
You're welcome.
When the time came to deploy the app, I was surprised by the asymmetry and hosting options for front versus back end. It seems like there are 1,000 slick free tier options for the front end, but finding a host for my Keystone back end, barf. I messed around with Heroku, but troubleshooting was a nightmare and eventually settled on a DigitalOcean droplet. My inner system admin is secretly happy to have another OS instance to manage, but I hate paying the $5 a month to host a silly project that will probably never be seen by anyone. I'm already irritated with the amount of care and feeding the backend needs. Yeah, for a side project, this sounds no fun.
It's kind of like our last question is,
yeah,
do you want to maintain it and pay the money yourself, or do you want to have a service?
We got a theme here. All right. He says, what gives? There are so many choices for front-end hosts and so few for back-end. Are there hosted back-ends that have auth, database, image hosting, et cetera, to take care of my nitty-gritty, newbie-friendly friendly free tier? Maybe I should look into serverless. So the free tier part is tough because... yeah, backend stuff is a little bit harder to get a free tier with. You know, one suggestion that I would say to look into is where we host is render.com. Render.com is cheaper and easier than Heroku. You could think of render.com as being like Netlify if Netlify had an option to do Netlify's front end thing, but for a Node app. We use render.com to host our Node backend, and it works the exact same way that Netlify does. You point it to a repo, you give it your build, your start command, it builds and your starts your thing, and you don't even think about it. It gives you environment groups, it gives you environment variables, any of that kind of stuff that you would want to need. So they also have serverless functions on there too if you need them. That's what I would recommend is checking out Render. The pricing is way, 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 way cheaper than Heroku, and we host our production there, so I'm a big fan.
Yeah, the backend is really tricky. And I actually just talked to Jed from Keystone about this. They're about to launch their Keystone 6, which is what I did my course on. And we should actually have him on because he's thought a lot about how to host these types of things that are Node apps, but they could be serverless. And like there's a lot of give and take. Like, why don't you see a lot of free backend? It's, first of all, because people abuse free backends. If you want to run something malicious on a server that is free, you are for sure to attract people sending spam, mining Bitcoin, all those types of bad things. Whereas you can do those types of things, some of them at least on the front end, but you need somebody to visit your website and for it to run JavaScript on the tab while they are sitting there and having it open. So that's kind of the first reason why. Front end is as much, I think it's like easier, quote unquote. It's definitely not easy to build these huge services that host your front end. But at the end of the day, you're just shipping HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to the client. And then the browser is actually running your app, not the actual back end, right? It's simply just a server that serves up the files, and then the browser runs the app. Whereas with server side, you're running the application on your actual server. So there's a lot more that goes on. And I always think that's like kind of funny that front end is basically like we give people our source code and say, like, you know what? You run it.
Yeah, it's up to you. You go do it.
You run it on your own browser. And which one? Any of them. Hopefully it supports it.
Yeah, hopefully.
Backend is sometimes tricky if your application is stateful, meaning that if you have sessions or something in memory or file uploads, things like that. A lot of these like easy to use platforms, Heroku, Vercel, they are built on serverless functions. And those are easy because they're stateless. You don't have to worry about databases and file uploads and writing to disk and all those types of things. You can't do that. And then when you get into those tricky things, like hosting images, you either have to go with a service like Cloudinary, Imagic, something like that, or you got to go through, like, wade through the waters of building your own Amazon S3 or look into some of the Cloudflare stuff that they've done. I think that stuff's getting a bit easier as we go on, but those are stateful, right? Because when somebody uploads an image to your application, that both needs to be stored somewhere, and then the URL to that image needs to be stored somewhere as well, which is a database. That's another hard part of doing backends. Like, how big of a database do you need? Do you need it to scale up? How many connections do you need to have at a single time? Some of the databases don't play well with serverless functions. There's a lot to think about there. I was talking to Jed from Keystone, and they're going all in on Prisma, which is really cool. And it's going to be much easier for things like migrations. So if you have a new front-end app, you simply just ship the new front-end app. And when the person refreshes the page, they've got the new app. Mm. On the back end, if the data is different, if you need to do some updates to the data, or if you are upgrading a different value of a database adapter or something like that, then you have to make sure that that all happens in sync and updates any data in the database. So that's a long way to say the server side is much more tricky. But I think there's a lot of companies that are trying to solve this, like Scott said, with Render. Or you need to think about these things from the start to be able to host them on serverless, along with some sort of database provider and some sort of image host, which the folks from Keystone are also working on that.
Yeah, I think if you're looking to just host a Node app somewhere, my experience has been that Render is good. There also is private services, too, that if you want a private service, like we have like a Redis server that runs privately.
Oh, that's cool.
Then that's like very doable on Render. And it's like mostly one click install. I know Heroku gets a little crazy with some of their apps and stuff, but the Render version is more or less, you install it as a private service. It gets you an address. You connect to that address and it just works really well. So that's been my experience with private services there. It's been pretty good.
Oh, and one more thing is you're not going to be $5 a month from Linode or DigitalOcean and running your own server. Because you're running your own box and maintaining it, it's much cheaper than, not always, but a lot of cases it is. Like, I'm just looking at Render. If you want to run a Node app on Render, $7 a month to do it, which is not bad. But then if you want to run another Node app, then do you have to pay another $7 a month? That's the same with DigitalOcean's app platform. If you want to run two Node apps on DigitalOcean's app platform, that's 5 times 2 a month. Whereas if you run your own server, as long as you're not maxing out the resources of that server, you can run as many apps as you could possibly want on a single server. Mm. Our next question here from Rustify. Rustify submitted like 15 questions the other day, and I think we answered a couple of them in the past. I'm very curious to hear what you think of this, Scott, because I know you've worked with Drupal in the past, and you were a fan of it at the time. So the question is, since Drupal has evolved beyond awkward clog, what do you think that means?
I have no idea.
Klug?
Klug? Awkward clog, Klug of V7. I mean, I use Drupal V7, but I don't know if it's just saying like V7 is weird.
Oh, Klug is like, if you Google image it, it's like a scary looking
guy.
Anyways. Of V7, entity, ctools, JSON services, PHD template, etc. And in V9, with the excellent GraphQL, JSON, REST support, and Tomb, not sure what Tomb is, for non-Drupal developers, would you recommend Drupal as a blogger business internal network for doc publishing communication systems, i.e. not Drupal as a website itself? This is kind of interesting. So you could just use it as a internal CMS, and this sort of like falls under the self-hosted CMS area, which is not like a service, but you host it yourself and you get all these things along. And you also get like, you can log in and have inputs and access control, and it does a little bit more for you. I think that just boils down to how easy it is to customize. It probably is a really good option. Seems like Drupal has really seen where their area will be is PHP devs that need a really, really flexible CMS that the data can be piped into literally anything. Like probably lots of iPhone apps are powered. The data is powered by a Drupal backend. So I think, yeah, I think that's probably a really good option, especially if you want to get up and running quickly. The people that I hear, like I never hear people bad talking about Drupal. It's either they don't talk about Drupal or they love it.
Well, maybe it's just because I spent, I don't know if it's like a self-loathing thing or something, but there's a lot of people in the Drupal community who at points or another were didn't have nice things to say about it. But I've always enjoyed it myself. And the neat thing about this question and, you know, this explanation here, because I have not been keeping up with Drupal. I'm going to admit that I primarily built sites in Drupal for a long time. The original version of Level Up Tutorials from 2012 to 2015 was all in Drupal. So I'm very familiar with it. In my opinion, Drupal's biggest strength is the admin editing interface and the admin and data. The data flexibility that you have with Drupal is really good. And that was the most frustrating thing for me when I would move to WordPress sites is having to deal with advanced custom fields, custom data types, and those types of things. In Drupal, I always felt like the whole experience was way easier, way better, and that you had more control over the data. And also, I always felt like, you know, if I was passing this off to a client, the client was almost always happier with the Word or with the Drupal version because the admin theming aspects of it were really baked in. You could do a lot for that admin theming section, and it worked really well with data and documents and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, I would definitely recommend people check that out then. I need to look at Drupal 9. It sounds like it's gotten pretty interesting. I honestly had no idea they were doing anything with GraphQL. And I always liked the content editing experience of Drupal. So I'll give this a check and see where it's at now. I'm interested.
Yeah, it looks like Drupal 9 just came out the other day. They have a fancy new icon. The little new metal flame drop is gone.
What's the new icon?
That's unfortunate. A moment of silence for the new metal flame drop. It's like a...
You know what? I should probably know the name of that thing. People like talk about it. The mascot guy.
Drupal, what is it, like Fred Durst or something?
Drupal Droopy.
Icon name, let's see. Droopy.
I feel like there's a missed opportunity if they didn't go with Droopy.
Droopy.
Yo, Drupal marketing people, get at me.
He always looked a little evil, don't you think?
Yeah, he had like weird shades on. And there's like versions of him with spiked hair and stuff. But yeah, he always looked kind of evil. He was a drop. The Drupal drop. It was like a droplet of water, I think. I think that's what it was. But yeah, he had some weird shades on.
The Druplicon, it's called.
Yeah, Droopy. Come on. You got to give him a name. Live him up. Give him a smile. We can give him a pal.
Well, clearly you missed that meeting because you would have killed it there. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'd like to present to you my idea. Droopy the drop.
This is Droopy the drop. He's got a pet squirrel named Snickers. The Snickers, the squirrel. Well, you know, they like to hang out in the backyard and sometimes they pretend to be an airplane guy on top of a doghouse. I don't know why. I'm just pulling stuff in from Snoopy. Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, on a different level, this episode is sponsored by LogRocket. Let's say you coded up a Droopy on your website and that Droopy was just not behaving right. Somebody, you're getting emails, they're saying, and hey, Droopy, he don't look right. So you go to check it out and Droopy looks okay to you. You said, I don't see what's going on here. I really just don't see why Droopy is not looking good. So then you fire up LogRocket, which has captured all of the errors and exceptions in your site. And you see that the user was seeing something totally different. And that Droopy was in fact all manipulated from some crappy JavaScript you had on your site. Well, you would never be able to do that or see that without asking the client for screen. Can you take a screenshot or a screen recording? Nobody wants to do that. Your client doesn't want to do that. And at the end of the day, you might have to ask them again for more information. What browser are you using? No, none of that anymore. You can use LogRocket. You can see the browser you're using. You can see what the user sees in a scrubbable video replay hosted to you along with the network tab and the error console, anything like that you would possibly want to debug an issue. So head on over to LogRocket.com /syntax. Sign up and get 14 days for free.
Beautiful.
This next question is from Brian Murray. Brian says, I have started my web development freelancing business, and I feel like I'm having a hard time getting a lot of responses from small businesses currently don't have a website. Is there any advice you can give about talking people into hiring a web developer when they clearly need help? I plan on using Next.js Insanity for all of my sites. My first client project is already built, and using it was a great developer experience. Thank you for all of the advice. The website looks great, Brian. Shout out. I don't know if you want me to read the URL on air, so I just won't. But the website looks great, and congrats on getting this thing done. This is a tough answer. Wes, do you want to take this one first?
Sure. What I've learned over the years is that many businesses don't necessarily need a website or one at all, or they don't think that they need one at all. And this is hard for me to say because I'm in the business of building websites and teaching people to build websites. But lots of small businesses depend on word of mouth, foot traffic, different things like that, where often if I need like an electrician or something like that to come to my website, or I need somewhere to go that sells cocoa butter or something like that, I'll almost always ask my friends or ask a bunch of people in a chat room over searching for that type of thing initially. So they might already be busy and be happy with their business. And they say, you know what, things are going well. But we kind of just saw that those types of people kind of got rocked when the pandemic came. They were forced to close down their businesses and they were scrambling to get their online presence up and running. And we saw lots and lots of companies. We had an entire show on this of like people didn't have the tech in place in order to communicate to their clients and in order to talk to their clients. They didn't even have a website or things like that. So I think if you were to use that as an example, like, first of all, you want to work with people that want to work with you, and you want to work with businesses that want to use tech to solve their business problems. And there's going to be lots of people out there that just think it's a waste of money or a waste of time, or they just don't want to focus on it. And those are not the people you should work with. But if you're having a hard time, like someone's maybe on the fence, be like, look, I had a lot of clients. They were sort of caught with their pants down when the pandemic came, and we're not able to get that information across to their people because they didn't have a website set up, or they didn't have a good one, or they didn't have a contact form or a way to clearly communicate. And they were stuck like spamming these JPEGs on Facebook, hoping that Facebook would show them to its people that are visiting their website, or they're just on the phone all day long answering questions, because that could certainly. So I would use that as a bit of a playing card as to why they should have a good website.
Yeah, we definitely did see that in terms of like everybody scrambling. And I think a lot of web devs probably were busy because of all the stuff that we were having to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good point, is that like, yeah, there, not everybody does need a website, but you know, certain companies and businesses, if they're small businesses and you know they need a site, you could always print, I know this is very old school, print up some cards and drop off a card, say, hey, I make some websites. I see you guys don't do online ordering or anything like that. You know, if you're interested in doing online ordering, I can do it on good value for you. Here's my card. If you're not interested, no worries. You know, I think that still flies. You just got to be willing to put yourself out there and do it. But yeah, you're right. I think, Wes, about everybody talking to somebody they know already about it. So everybody knows somebody. Like, for instance, our realtor, he's really good. And if, you know, we need anything in that realm, he's the first person we talk to. And if you're on his list, then that's probably a good thing for you, because it seems like he gets a lot of trust put in him to, you know, refer out. So it's going to be about making those connections, and whether or not that is, you know, old school style, just connecting with other people and talking about what you do, or, you know, going to businesses and doing it that way, or even just promoting yourself online more. There's a lot of aspects you can go about with it. But again, it's a tough thing to crack into. I personally was never very good at it. I ended up doing like the answering Craigslist ads. And believe it or not, you hear a lot of horror stories from Craigslist, but I had maybe more positive client experiences than the negative ones on Craigslist, which is sort of surprising considering its reputation. But yeah, there's always things like that, Upwork, forums like that, looking for work where people post looking for it, but a lot of competition.
Next question we have here from James Obel. What do you consider the best alternative to the BEM naming convention? So BEM is a convention that allows you to write CSS so that your selectors are scoped. It's a block element modifier. You make a block like a card, and then you have an element like a card header, and then you have a modifier like card header long. Maybe when that's over 50 characters, you bump the font size down, something like that. I personally follow a method with very few classes. I've seen this called GPS, which takes advantage of the CSS cascade, but I do think I may suffer from readability problems. If I handed my stuff to another developer to work on, interested to hear your thoughts. So GPS, you ever heard of that, Scott?
Nope, never heard of it. GPS, it's a tough Google too.
Yeah, I Googled it and I found it. And the intro blog post to it says BEM is terrible, which immediately puts me off of it, because anytime someone has to like trash another piece of technology to like introduce their new thing, like, come on, that's not cool. Anyways, but I went into it. It seems reasonable. GPS stands for global, page, and section. So the idea is that you have some global CSS for stuff that's used, and then you have an ID for every single page that you're on, and then inside of that, you have your sections. And it makes kind of sense to me, except that, like I've said in the past couple of podcasts, is kind of moving away from like page-based. And even if it says in the docs here, like you could do it section-based, but I would think like component-based is probably the way to go, because then you can move those suckers wherever it is you want. So that's what GPS is. Anyways, I think component CSS matched with a bunch of global helpers is probably the way to go with CSS right now. That's just my opinion. There's lots of people that will disagree with that. But I don't think that the alternative to BEM is going to be a new one of these things that someone comes out with. I think it's going to be either a tool that helps you automatically scope your CSS, like style components or svelte kits built in, things like that. Or ideally, CSS, the language, will have this scoping built into it pretty soon. And it will allow you to say, all right, here's my card component. And then you can select the H2 inside of that. You don't have to put a class on it. You can select the paragraph tags inside of that. You don't have to put a class inside of that. And, oh, I got two images. Let me throw a class on one of them so I can apply some CSS to that. And I think that, for me at least, that's my way going forward with CSS.
Yeah, and that's largely how I'm writing my CSS right now. I think BEM is fine. BEM is just really a standard for writing class names. It's basically like, here's how you write your class names. But many of these things, they're really trying to solve the problem of, like you said, scoping. And scoping is not something you need to do all the time, but there are times when scoping can really come in handy. Our base level CSS for our theme is done, you know, in a way that like we don't have to use that many classes. And if we're doing one-off CSS work, it's being done at the component level in a scoped manner to say like, this is how this thing is. But if we're doing or thinking in components, you know, I'm largely thinking in components, and BEM does come in handy, but I don't write strict BEM CSS myself anyways. I do just say, hey, here's the component, here's its class name, and then the children. Since we are using Svelte, we have that scoping by default, so I don't have to worry about it too much. But I don't think this GPS is any better than BEM for any particular reason. You're dead on, Wes, with your saying global CSS with some scoped to components where needed. And then I would also toss in there, use a couple of utility classes, because I don't want to turn this into a utility class thing, but utility classes can be really great. And just because they're really great doesn't mean you have to write your entire CSS with utility classes. You know what I mean? And that definitely is like a pendulum. People will like toss a couple of utility classes on there and be like, oh man, this is great for this little bit. We might as well, you know, put 18 classes on this element. I think you can get away with using utility classes to augment your global styles and your scope to component styles for utility, you know, not to style the whole thing. So, you know, GPS, BEM, CSS, SAS, scope, CSS, I don't think it really matters. Just as long as your stuff is organized and able to be readable and writable by the people on your team, everybody's on the same page, and there isn't like 8 different styles and systems of CSS writing on your team.
Beautifully said.
Next question here is from Nick. I have been teaching myself web development for a little over a year, and your show has been a big help. I'm getting to the point where I feel that I'm nearly qualified for jobs and I will be starting the application journey soon. I currently work in the supply chain management at a big corporation with a background of industrial engineering. My question for you is, seeing that I have work experience at a big company with a STEM background, do you think that holds weight in terms of being qualified for a dev job? I am mainly wondering how much I should leverage it during my interviews on my resume. Yeah, you should leverage this because, you know, when I'm interviewing people in the past or even now, I suppose, but, you know, when you're talking to people to see if they're a good fit on your team, if you're getting to the interview part of it, sure, there's probably going to be technical questions and technical outlook on your abilities of what you can do. But at most normal companies, non-Google size companies, the hiring process is very much more personal in a way. It's like these people are just feeling you out to see if you can work on a team successfully, if you can be part of the team, if you can fit in and you can be a team player, those types of things. You're going to communicate well and listen and, you know, be the type of person that other people want to work with. And if you have a background in, you know, STEM, whatever, but if you have a background working in a larger corporation or you have been doing prominent work in whether it is non-coding or whatever, leverage that stuff. They ask you those questions about, you know, what is your experience with this in management? Or have you ever had to give me a situation where something went wrong and how did you fix it type of deal? Those types of questions. Man, you should be loading up those questions with, well, when I was a part of this team, we worked on these problems. It doesn't matter if it's coding related. They're going to love to hear that stuff. So yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I agree as well. I think like, you've worked in a technological setting before. You have an engineering background. You have a big company behind you. You probably have very good organization skills. If you say you're working in supply chain management, that stuff can get hairy real quick. So use all of those things to your advantage because those are all very good skills. There's just one new skill you're adding, and that is being a developer on top of that. So you've got more skills than not right now. So good luck with that.
Yeah, you would not believe how many people that I've worked with personally who didn't have those types of skills. And, you know, it's clear that this person was primarily a freelancer or something because they couldn't work with others in a positive way. So, yeah, those things will go a long way for you and they will make you a good employee with anybody. Cool. Well, now is I survived, Wes. I did not fall asleep. Even though I'm not caffeinated. So I made it. And I even came up with a mascot, Droopy. Good old Droopy. Let's...
Droopy. Yeah, I'm impressed at that.
Yes. I have a little like stress toy Droopy around here somewhere. I'll have to find and put him on my desk. So let's get into the part of the show where we talk about sick picks, things that we pick that are sick. Sick as in good, not sick as in sick. Wes, you have a sick pick for us today.
I do. I think probably 2 years ago, I sick picked a YouTube channel, Matthias Wandel, who is a Canadian, used to work at RIM or BlackBerry. And he has this channel called Wood Gears, and he builds all this stuff out of plywood. And it's just fascinating. He's a super smart guy. And so he has another channel called Matthias Random Stuff. And a couple of weeks ago, he posted a video about fixing a fan. Like he just has all these like things in his life where he fixes them or solves them. And he's very like data heavy approach to things. Like he'll put sensors on like he was trying to make a homemade vacuum press. And he would just put sensors in it and graft it on a Raspberry Pi and like very data driven. So he had one where he was fixing a fan and he showed how he had it sitting in front of the window, pushing air into the house or out of the house. I forget which one it was. So I commented and said, I need you. This is always the big fight, not a fight, but with myself and my family and my friends. It's like, is it better when it's hot out to put a fan in the window and pull the air in or pull the hot air in the house out? So what he did is I was like, I want to see a video with the science and the data behind that. And he actually made one. And I was so happy.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's called Best Fan Placement to Move Air Through the House. And he has Raspberry Pi hooked up to a, I don't know, some meter that shows how fast the airflow is moving. And it was, all the right answers were not what I was doing. So I was really happy to see it and see some data behind it.
So what are the right answers here?
The right answer was you have to keep it at least 2 feet away from the window. So don't put the fan in the window and point the fan out the window. So blow the air in the house out. And that what that will do is it will create like a negative pressure and pull cool air in. So I have always been doing the opposite. Like we have a fan in our window because it cools down here at night. So we usually don't have to have the AC on, which is nice. And then we're pumping the air in. But now I'm going to flip it around.
So yeah, that's interesting. Okay. I gotta check this out. Okay. That sounds like something that I would be very into.
I tweeted it and like every web developer was like, thank you. I've been wondering this for my entire life.
Yeah. Yeah. And engineering is fascinating, right? My sick pick for today is a podcast that I really like to listen to called I Was There Too from Matt Gourley. Matt Gourley is like kind of an improv comedian. He does a bunch of podcasts. I listened to another podcast of his that maybe I can do a double sick pick of his. He did Super Ego with Paul F. Tompkins. It's just like an improv comedy podcast that's really good. He also did The Neighborhood. Oh, no, he didn't do The Neighborhood. Listen, Paul F. Tompkins did that. But he did this podcast. They call it an easy listening horror podcast because they just talk about horror movies. And the episodes will be like a couple hours long. And it's like two actors that are just like really, really, you know, cool dudes. Not in like the actually cool way, but like they're like, I don't know. They're just interesting guys. They're the type of people that you'd want to listen to talk for a long time. They have a lot of stories about Hollywood because they were both actors, but not like ever actors. They're both like super nerdy. So like the nerdiness is like very, very relatable. And so, yeah, that was, it's called with Gourley and Rust is the horror one. But the one I'm talking about specifically is I Was There Too with Matt Gourley. And he interviews people who were in movies that weren't a main actor or a main character or a non-big actor. So they'll interview the guy who played Jar Jar Binks in Star Wars. Here's an episode with the passengers on the bus of the movie Speed. So he's just like interviewing the people who are also in the movie, but never get interviewed. So I Was There Too. Silence of the Lambs with Brooke Smith. It's just like random people. And this is a really great podcast. It's super fascinating. Matt's a really great interviewer. And you get some really wild stories from these people who are like, oh yeah, I was like a personal trainer. And then I got scooped up to be in this major motion picture. And next thing I knew, I was meeting Michael Jackson. And then like, I never did anything else. It's like whirlwindish. It's very good, very wholesome. So check it out. I Was There Too. Good podcast.
That sounds awesome. Give that a listen. Shameless plugs, westboss.com/courses. That has a list of all of the web development courses that I make. If you want to learn React, Gatsby, you want to learn beginner JavaScript, advanced React and GraphQL, you name it, westboss.com/courses. Everything is currently on sale for summer. Use 10 coupon code syntax for $10 off.
I am going to shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. I don't know if I've ever shamelessly plugged this thing before, but this is my website that I make tutorial videos on. And you know what? I do a new series every single month. The current series that's coming out the day that I'm recording this podcast is on building Svelte components, where we look into advanced Svelte techniques in components, as in we build some neat stuff. Like we build a whole toast message system that does flip animations. And we look into more in depth on stores. So like if you're looking to subscribe to data and have your data available like a global store throughout. So we build some more advanced functionally stores. We look into more into Svelte actions to do like a use click outside of an object type of deal. And just a bunch of little like handy things wrapped up into a course that teaches you how to build maintainable components. So check it out at leveluptutorials.com/pro.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hopefully you enjoyed that one and we'll catch you on Monday.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.